Welcome to Keeping It 99, your one-stop shop podcast for everything in the world of heavy metal, rock and roll, Northeast Ohio. Sometimes none of that. My name is Eagle, and today, we're going to be talking some more nostalgia. We like to talk about the future. I love to talk about the present. Sometimes it's just really cool to talk about the past. A few weeks ago, we did an episode about Crypt Kicker, and not to brag, since that episode, I'm now friends with two of the guys that were in the band on Facebook. Big shit popping for you, boy. Speaking of big shit popping, today we're talking to Dan Cole, who we're talking about Peabody's, man. And Dan was the guy, he ran Peabody's for years. He owned Peabody's for a while. Dan is booked probably thousands of bands. He booked my band's first few shows. He hooked us up with Crowbar, Vanilla Ice, like all kinds of cool opportunities came from dealing with Dan and Peabody's. And when I wanted to do a Peabody's episode, I wanted to have somebody that had some insight. And I was thinking, I was like, oh, my buddy, Reverend Jim, who's, he does the voice stuff on here. He's out in Hollywood right now. He's a Transformer. He plays Hound in the Netflix show Transformers. And since he does our voice stuff on this show by proxy, I'm also a Transformer. But Jim was like, you got to get Dan on the show, man. He was like, nobody has lived Peabody's, breathed Peabody's, sweat, slept Peabody's, bathed in Peabody's, right, more than Dan. And I was like, dude, I didn't even think of that. And Dan was, he was totally fucking down to sit on a computer and talk with me for a while, man. And I'm glad that he did. I'm gonna tell you this right now. You're not gonna learn more about Peabody's in any other 45-minute format. More than you're going to hear. So I'm gonna shut my mouth. We're gonna get into it. If you like this show, subscribe. Tell your friends. Spread the word, man. We're gonna be doing another nostalgic Cleveland metal one here soon. Next one, it's dropping real soon. Me and my boy Daily Davis, we're gonna be doing our favorite Jason Popson projects. And then I'm going to go back to like some sort of normal format show. Whatever. This show's what I want it to be. It's my show. All right. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to stop doing this. Hope you enjoy this talk with Dan. Boom. Is that a phrase I could say?
Ladies and gentlemen, from the heart of the heartland, it's time for Keeping It 99.
This man, Dan Cole, has booked, you booked for Peabody's for roughly 8 years, from 98 to 2005. Yep. And I have to start it off with this. When I was a young kid and I was going to shows, I discovered the underground music scene by going to Peabody's, driving up to Cleveland, going to Peabody's. My dream was to play shows, ultimately to open up for Mushroomhead. It was the 90s. I wanted to open up for the Mushroomhead at Peabody's. And when I finally started a band, did the 6 months of rehearsing the 5 songs that we knew, I made the phone call to Peabody's Down Under to see how to book a show. And on the other end of that phone was you. It was the most positive voice I ever heard in my life answering. And you offered us a spot. It was during the day on a Saturday for a battle of the bands. You were like, you said, come on up, pick up these tickets, sell some tickets. We'll see how the crowd response goes. And then the next 5 shows, I want to say that we did, were all at Peabody's. Like that kickstarted the next 5 years of my life. And I know for a fact that I'm not the only person that has a similar story with hearing that voice, because you were so encouraging. Like you never even, like you didn't even have to hear us. You were just like, give it a shot. If you guys are good, you're going to be a draw. Like, I'll give you a stage and a format to do that. How did, so first of all, I just want to say thank you for kickstarting, a great 5-year run as a local band. And I did eventually open up for Mushroomhead. Dreams came true. But how did you get that? How did you get into that position? Because you were a young guy, right, when you started with Peabody's?
So my brother actually owned the club.
Okay.
So my brother owned the club. It was a week after my 21st birthday. I had already been like a gopher for him. I've done security for him, been like a door guy, did some cleanup, did like labor, you name it. I did it, like, other than like booking the bands and actually being like the manager of the place, I I did all the other jobs, and I was living in New York at the time. And it was a week after my 21st birthday, and my brother had his manager was stealing from him. And he literally said, "Hey, obviously I can trust you. Would you like to be my general manager and my booking agent in the club?" And I was like, "Hell yeah, that'd be amazing." And that's how it all started for me. You know, at the end of the day, he called me, and literally a week after my 21st birthday, I started being the general manager and the booking agent. I managed Heaven up above, the dance club.
Okay.
So I was the manager of that. And then I booked the bands for Peabody's. Peabody's was obviously the more labor intensive piece of it. At night, all you literally did was just, you ran around and gave people change for the management job. You know what I mean? Make sure the girls were dancing in the windows.
You know? Yeah.
that was about it. But as far as Peabody's, there was like a lot of, I was there during the day, and obviously you had to book all the bands. And then I had like an assistant. Ironically, my assistant is the one that trained me. He's the one that he's like, "Ian, here's the band Bible, book some bands." And I was like, I had booked a couple raves at Peabody's.
Okay.
There was a couple, like my first group I ever booked, the first artist was DJ Funk. Charles Chambers called me at my house. I was like 18. And I had a company called Super Dang Productions. We did like Bad Boy Bill shows. And we had the first show we did was at Peabody's, had over 1,000 people. We started it at Saturday night after a by accident, the metal band.
I remember that band.
They played till 1 a.m. We opened our doors at 1 a.m. and we had a line past Hooters. There was 1,000 people showed up. My brother's like, "No one's going to show up at 1:00 a.m. I'm like, "I need it from 1 to 10 a.m.
Yeah.
That thing. And we did. The after party was at the Euclid Tavern till 5:30 in the afternoon.
Oh man.
My brother owned the Euclid Tavern too, actually. He owned the building for the Euclid Tavern as well back then.
I was
a cook. I was even a cook for like their wing night before and stuff like that at the Euclid Tavern.
Oh wow. So you did it all. So you were pretty much just brought into that business. So I'm assuming like it was something that you were used to before you got in, since your brother owned the club, right? Like, so.
Yeah, so it was the ability, because my brother owned the club, that's why I got to throw my, that's why I like all of our, my being, my buddies were ravers, but I actually could throw an event because my brother had a venue. There was also, my brother did some wild nights on Sundays. Obviously Trilogy had like a big Sunday night going on, Metropolis and Trilogy on Sundays, but he did a thing that was like from midnight to 6 a.m. with just weird avant-garde artists. So he was familiar with the whole, you know, up real late party goers type of thing. But I brought the whole rave atmosphere, the whole before EDM was EDM to Peabody's.
When you were starting, was it like everything was just in, like up to you? You know what I mean? Was like the whole process of like
the battle of the bands and stuff like
that? Yeah, stuff like that. Like, was that all you?
No, my brother was the genius of the whole thing, actually. I was just the encouraging, uplifting, motivating speaker guy. You know what I mean? Same with sales nowadays. I sell like outdoor security now. And like literally, I'm the only guy that sells sometimes the product because they like me. You know what I mean? Literally, it's just I'm uplifting, and I try to always be that guy to be positive. And you know what I mean? It's just that's my fit. So I was kind of the guy that pushed my brother's thoughts and dreams. You know what I mean? I was the ability, the implementer. I was the implementer. And the Battle of Bands actually got started because he needed a way. So right after he bought Peabody's off of Tom and Dewey, they were the originators of Peabody's, the founders. Michael Belkin with Live Nation now, but Belkin Productions was really big, and they did a lot of shows at Peabody's. Well, like a month after my brother bought Peabody's, he started the Odeon. So he not only did they have the biggest competition ever right down the street, literally on the same street,
right,
but they lost their biggest promoter that was doing like 5 to 10 shows a month there. So my brother had lost like $30,000 like the first 2 months he was opening in Peabody's.
Oh,
so it was like going to go out of business like within 6 months type of thing, the way that they were producing. So my brother, he was in a band with a band called The Act. Back, I was like my first concert in 1988. They rented out the club and sold tickets. You know what I mean? So he did it for his own band. The whole invention of the band selling tickets is because he needed to raise capital to make studio time and to make t-shirts. So he bought t-shirts. He got cassettes going, and you know, he did that all through the ticket sales of renting out the room. And then he, you know what I mean? That so he basically took the t-shirt money and was able to pay for the room, that type of whole thing. He basically took the money to raise income. So with that being said, he just came up with the Battle of the Bands idea to basically find a way to find the new headliners, to develop artists. So he, what he would do is the first Battle of the Bands winner would be the next headliner. Our first Battle of the Band winner was Kamira, for instance. That was the first Battle of the Band winner ever.
I've heard of them. I've heard of them.
A little bit, right? A little bit. A little bit, yeah. So like at the end of the day, the next one after that, you know, Rock of Fabian next. Rock of Fabian was one of the big ones too. They drew about 500 people for us. Every time we booked them about 7-8 times a year. But they were a band from St. Ignatius that were kids from four different schools, and they were a hippie band that drew like nuts. But all the bands, big like Saxatromba, we found like so many different bands that we would develop from the Battle of the Bands. You probably know Dan Jansen that does like the Ink Festival.
Oh yeah.
Well, he was like the fourth Battle of the Band winner ever. His band last August, that was one of my headliners for like 10 years after the Battle of the Band. You know what I mean? Peabody's. It was just anybody that won the battle was drawing 150, 250 people. Like I said, a Rock the Baby, and they drew 500 for the finals once. The second place was a band called Twitch from Youngstown that drew over 200 people from Youngstown, and they lost. They got second place. Yeah, I felt bad for that band. If they'd have played in another battle, they'd have won it. But they played.
Yeah, any other one.
Yeah, they probably would have won it. So the thing was is that that's just how we developed the artist. It turned into not only just a moneymaker, but also how we developed Fridays and Saturdays. And then it became how we booked our shows. So the reason it was also great for the locals was so we booked big nationals. Like when I would book Danzig or George Clinton, I wouldn't make much money on those shows, ironically. I just did that for the historical value and the wanting like the bands. We did make money on Mushroomhead. But we made money from Friday, and they were a local band, even though they're a national band. They were really like our local band because we had them play like seven times a year. And with the 216 and all the side projects like Dog Fashion Disco and 13 Faces, all the sister bands and everything, we looked at Jason Pops and all the side projects, sold out the club six times plus two sister bands. We had 8 sellouts with just their group of bands in 1 month. You know, he should have been on payroll, like, clocking in. We made a joke. He had his own time card in the back.
Yeah,
he eventually ended up bartending there too later on. But during my time when I owned it, he literally had a time card. So when he would come in as a musician, he literally punched in with a time card. It was a joke because he just sold out our club so much.
That is incredible. I kid you not. Later this week, if you know Daily Fatback Davis, we're doing an episode that is about all of the Pops and projects.
Oh, that's gonna be a great. Great episode,
Jason.
He's the Mike Patton to Cleveland. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. I've never had a bad thing to say about J-Man. In fact, like a lot of idol worship. You know, when I was growing up, he was like I had posters of that guy, and so to be able to see bands like State of Conviction or Unified Culture or 216, it was always at Peabody's, and all like not when since you're bringing it up, yeah, it was always packed for his band. So that that cracks me up.
Even 10,000 like, Cadillacs that never performed would pack it. It was crazy. Yeah. It was crazy stuff. But yeah. So, anyways, the format for Peabody's essentially though was to take care of the locals on Fridays and Saturdays because that was our bread and butter, and then on top of that. It forced the national bands to play on a Sunday through Thursday, which we believe they would draw about 90% of their crowd because they only played one time a year. Where all the local bands, we try to get them to play 5 or 6 times a year at our location, but only play on Fridays and Saturdays because, you know, they couldn't draw on a Thursday or Sunday. You know what I mean? Unless we did like a ticket giveaway. I know we drew like a Monday night. We started with Derek Hess and like hard rock bands like your Ringworms and your 216s and your Peel Halls and all those bands, the Abdullahs back in the day, you know, we played them on Mondays and we gave out free tickets. And we do about 500 people on a Monday every Monday because everybody knew for 2 years straight we did Hard Rock Mondays. You know what I mean? And Derek Hess would come out with a new flyer for me with the new next 2 months of bands or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, we made sure that, like, you know, if Fu Manchu was coming through town, if we could get him on that Monday, that would be perfect because that was our niche on that Monday. And Tuesday was our, you know, our electronic night. Plus, we had 80s night going on. We had our Wednesday college ID night. So we tried to build up each particular individual night. Obviously, our Saturdays and Sunday afternoons, Battle of the Bands. Fridays and Saturday nights were our local band headliner nights. Mm-hmm. And we tried to develop so that we were always in demand. I think with Peabody's Pirates Cove and Rockstar, I think our record was like 114 shows in 1 month between the three venues.
Holy shit.
Yeah, because we would sometimes we would run a battle of the bands into a show, into a rave, into a battle of bands next day into the show. Like, oh, we would just, God. Yeah, we had done that before.
Did you ever sleep? Did you ever sleep throughout this time period?
Great staff. Like, Power Man 5000 Spider came one time. He's like, there's only one reason this club's freaking amazing. He's like, Dan, I know you work your butt off, but your staff is out of control, man. They're the best. And we did. We had the best staff. Some of the staff is still working over at the Agora, and some of our security people were like the management, and all of our security guys, like our main guys, are running freaking AEG stuff, like for like their development, running Jacob's the pavilion now this year. So It's like, obviously I hired the right people, because those are the people that are still in the industry now.
We're oh yeah,
the family at Peabody's back then.
When you look back at your days with Peabody's, would you say that it was a predominantly like a hard rock kind of club? Because every show that I went there, with the exception of like a few, kind of like I did see Kid Rock there, with a few exceptions.
It's funny that you bring up Kid Rock, because the first thing that came to my head was David Allan Coe. I'd book him on the weekends because that was his crowd would come out on the weekends.
Okay.
But there were so many things that I tried to always do to make us not anything. Like, I didn't want to be a hip hop club, even though we did a lot. Like, I had free Jay-Z concert there. I hosted Snoop Dogg's birthday party. You know, but, you know, we wanted to be a little bit of everything. Like, we had My Chemical Romance playing the Pirates Cove. You know, it's the difference we wanted to be was, my goal was to try to get Buckwheat Zydeco always there on, like, during Mardi Gras. You know, have Packy Malley put on his reggae shows, and Jim Wadsworth from Nighttown put on a couple jazz shows for the year. I always wanted to get a different vibe as much as I possibly could with as many genres. We like doing the Howard Stern comedy that we did with, what was the guy? Artie Lang. You know what I mean? Yeah, that type of stuff. We used to love doing that type of thing just because we wanted to be as diverse as possible. Like, one time, the craziest thing I ever did, and I did it by accident because I didn't look into things like I should have, but I didn't. And I rented my club out, one to hip hop, and the other one was like combat boots, like from England, the Blitz. It's like, it's close to KKK as you could get, basically, kind of like skinheads, right? And the one guy comes up to me and says, Dan, you know, dead bodies are bad for business. And he shows me his gun. And I was like, dude, Trev, I know that dead bodies are bad for me. Why are you doing this? And he shows me the flyer with the combat. I'm like, dude, I don't look into this kind of stuff. So I was like, I don't know whose hate groups are whose. You know what I mean? I had no idea. Obviously, nowadays, you definitely have to look into more of that shit. I had no idea. I had never come across this type of thing.
Right.
So I was like, well, it sounds like we're getting some extra security tonight. And I got like 18 guys, the biggest guys I could that night. I took care of it, ate the cost from both shows because they were both room rentals. I ate it because I made the mistake. And people were like sharing the bathrooms and everything. Uh-huh. And I was in there to make sure everybody was cool with each other because everybody had to intermingle. And there was actually four fights that night, two on each side. But each with their own crowds, right? Remember when they intermixed. And the intermixed, I was there and everybody was peeing. They're like, this is messed up. But the funny part about it was like, that was the place to do it. If there was any place in the world, like Peabody's brought everybody in. I used to deal with the homeless to the billionaires. And it's the truth. Like every walk of life was at Peabody's. And that's what I always, as the booking agent, wanted to bring to the table. And as the owner, I wanted everybody in the world to be welcome. The Robert Ritchies of the world, the guy that strapped the chicken. I wouldn't let him, kill a chicken on stage. So he killed it ahead of time and wore it as his underwear. And he was a drunk poet. They used to like, he would get messed up, like chewed up and just like pass out on stage with cigarettes on him. And the guy was a weird genius though. And it's like, it was just this type of shit that Peabody's did. You know what I mean? It didn't matter what it was, you know, It was about just bringing diversity and everybody in every walk of life to Peabody's.
Yeah, there was
asses in the seats, no matter what the ass looked like.
I always felt a great sense of community up at Peabody's amongst like the people like going within. You got to see the local music scene, and that's what this podcast heavily focuses on, is especially like the heavy metal scene within the Northeast Ohio area. You got to see it really take off So is there any bands from that time that absolutely just surprised you and blew up? And to counter that, is there any bands that you can think of from like that late 90s, early 2000s time frame that should have made it to the next step in your opinion? Maybe they just disbanded, something happened.
Well, ironically, Mushroomhead, I think you're going to gotten way bigger myself because of the 13 album and everything. And just they had some issues. They should have been bigger than Slipknot. I always thought that. And they just didn't sign that particular part of the deal with Roadrunner. But that's a whole nother story. But even after the fact with Universal, with their A&R rep and everything, they got fired. It just sucked because I think they could have just been like, they're big. Don't get me wrong. But they could have been like household name Machine Gun Kelly big. You know what I mean? Like kind of like a Metallica type of band. I always thought that. Like Jason, like he's like we said, he's like the Mike Patton of Cleveland. And Mike Patton, the reason he's not bigger is on purpose. He's actually the coolest guy I've ever dealt with at Peabody's. He would literally settle his own shows, load out his own equipment. He was just freaking the most down to earth out of every musician that was fucking amazing. With that being said, just to think of other bands, there was, you know, good bands. There was the you know, I'm thinking of like Second Half and Audible Thread, but that's more alternative rock. But there was like, of the metal scene, there was some really like Rob Runt, you know, with 13 Faces, they did amazing. Like they would draw a good crowd and I used to pack the place, but you know, there was like, for instance, Keelhaul, and they're still around, you know what I mean? Ringworm, those bands were big back then and they're still around today. And I think those bands could be even bigger to this day. You know what I mean? If, you know, Relapse or somebody like that put more money behind those guys, you know, they could have gotten a lot bigger. Let's see, who else? You know, we have a great metal scene in Cleveland because, you know, at the end of the day, we're Cleveland. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I'm sure, I don't know Pittsburgh's metal scene, to be frank, even though I've done a lot of shows at the different venues there. But not like them out in Cleveland. And I would assume that'd be like another city like us. You know what I mean? That would be like a good metal scene, or like places like Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh. You think of metal when you think of those type of cities, like hardworking people that rock some metal music. You know what I mean?
The whole Rust Belt, just that vibe for sure.
That vibe for Cleveland. So as far as other bands though, in the 90s and in the early 2000s, man, I'm trying to think of my headliners that I used to just try to develop. You know, Dog Fashion Disco was incredible. That band was just off the hook. They're still around too, and they got a hell of a loyal fan base. Who was some of the other ones that I thought that just could have been huge? You know, when you just say really rock and roll, I think there was only one member from Cleveland, but Beautiful Creatures I thought were going to blow up. They're more like hard rock, but I thought that band was going to be huge. Plus they got like $2 million from Warner Brothers and then just got shelved. It was so weird.
That's so insane.
Yeah, they were one of my headliners I'd bring in on Mondays because they would actually be able to play the place like 2-3 times. We did them like 1 year and then they disappeared. You know, some of the other bands that we develop are bands like McGregor. McGregor was like Virginia Coalition. They're like the jam band ones. The New Deal was another one that was like an EDM band out of, I believe they were out of Canada, actually. I think, anyways, but they were basically, we just try to get behind these bands that were, you know, they were drawing 100-150 people and you could push them in the right direction. You know, it was just awesome. And we had bands like Sponge that would only draw 75 people, but the local bands would bring 700 to play with them. You know what I mean? So it was awesome. Like we'd have a saw 800 people when the headliner was bringing 75 people.
That's how I always remember being like one of the opening local cats. And when we would get show, you would book us with like a national act. Like we were just excited to be playing with a band that we looked up to, you know what I mean? And so even if they didn't have, you know, if they're only drawing like 75, you know, and we're bringing in, you know, if I'm going to be honest, our 20 to 40, you know, we're bringing those in. It was still just such a great experience, even if there wasn't a lot of people there for like the opening acts and stuff, because you guys brought in so many good bands that were like up and coming. Like, you know, it was always like other bands that hit their peak and they were kind of kind of starting to go a little down, or bands that are on the rise. And either way, it was just being a young local band, it was always fun to be able to play those shows. And just to say that I played a show with Vanilla Ice Dan Call is still like, I still have that in my pocket. I still throw that out sometimes.
I hung out with them that night till like 6 a.m. It was awesome.
It was so cool. So Peabody's Down Under, I remember going there for firstly with it being down in the flats. The flats were hot. There was, you know, there was all kinds of things going on, and then they ended up moving, and you were a part of that transition time. Can you tell us a little bit about like why Peabody's ended up making the move from the flats to a new location?
Oh yeah, I know the whole story in times 10. We won't talk about the city of Cleveland. We'll just talk about Peabody specifically.
Gotcha.
So what happened was my brother basically realized that Peabody's, because the whole time my brother's always been the brains. He had a business partner, very formal, great business guy, OCD business, bought my brother a lot of stuff too, because he owned a business called Perfect Business before even. The guy does huge $70 million real estate deals, and he's consulting now for people. Mm-hmm. The guy, he's a brainiac when it comes to business. But my brother was always the arts guy that understood the business. So he realized that Peabody's doesn't need the East Bank of the Flats destination, because it's a destination location, great business for the name and the brand, but It didn't need to be there because people will drive to go see their favorite band or whatever. You didn't have to have the heart of Cleveland right there. And if you opened a bar, just a regular bar, Armored Saint, I remember the fucking band. Armored Saint was the band. We lost $3,500 on the show. It was a Tuesday night, I believe. And my brother came in the next day and said, fuck this. We're going to do a dance club. Because on the dance club, he's never lost money once. Not one night did he ever lose money opening the dance club. Okay. Because he'd always bring like $400 or $500, and that could pay for your staff at least. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The bartenders, you didn't pay much. You just had to have a door guy and a security guard. You know what I mean? The manager for the club. Right. So the point was, though, he never lost money once. And sometimes we'd make $10,000, $15,000 at the bar on Fridays and Saturday nights. And that never happened to Peabody's, even at a Dave and Allen Co show. Because the way the bar was set up. At the new Peabody's, we would end up bringing crazy numbers because the bar was much bigger at the new establishment. Plus, it was four sides instead of it smaller, the way the three side was ringed. So basically, my brother's like, all right, we're going to move it. They didn't have a location for it. I actually started booking. I was in the band dressing room, moved to my office in the dressing room, and we built out Earth. And I started booking bands at Nick's Fat City in Pittsburgh and Top Cats in Cincinnati, just to be able, and I started moving my shows to like the Revolution, and just any place I could get a room, a bunch of the Fantasy, and I was still doing shows, but I was having to put them in different rooms, kind of like when the House of Blues came into town and they had to just do them in as many rooms as they could before they opened the House of Blues.
Okay.
I was in the same boat, so I had no venue, but I had to just do shows to keep myself relevant. Then they got Dan Bliss actually negotiated the deal with Mr. Frangos for the 21st in Euclid over at the Rascal House. We opened on March 1st. The reason I bring up the city of Cleveland now, on March 1st was the day the East Bank of the Flats fell. So my brother had the club going now from Earth, and we were bringing in $40,000, $50,000 on Fridays and Saturday nights between the two places sometimes. Like, it was just freaking raking in cash. He sold it for $420,000 on March 1st, that night, they shut down the East Bank of the Flats in like seven different places. And that Monday was going in the escrow. And it was the craziest thing ever. And it was the grand opening of the new Peabody's. So without that happening, I never owned Peabody's, because my brother would just be running Peabody's. He'd had plenty of money too. And just own Peabody's and everything would have been fine. But that's the only reason I got to buy Peabody's off of him, was because everything was in shambles. Everything had come down basically because of the city. He ended up selling that same to the same people for $120,000 and had to do like $40,000 improvements just to get it there. So he lost over $300,000. Ended up being, he won a lawsuit for $450,000 against the city. However, the city appealed it and was in the wrong court. So we got like $225,000 from the negligence of the attorneys for putting it in the wrong court. And the investors got paid. So we got some of their money and everything. And it just didn't work out to be the same type of boat. And it was just, that was years and years down the road after I had owned Peabody's already for a while. My brother literally, I gave him his money. He had packed his bags and moved to LA. He was just, he was done with this city. And he came back years later and we became partners at Gorilla Music, where we did shows all over the country in 85 different cities and 150 different clubs. Because he had a production company in California, and then we merged together after I sold Peabody's.
Once again, since this is like a local scene show, you've had to seen a countless amount of shows. What are one or two of your absolute favorite shows, most memorable shows that you as just a fan experienced at Peabody's, man?
Local band?
Any band, any show. Because I know you dealt with some big dogs, so like whatever it is, I want to hear it.
The fact, obviously, it's the Jay-Z one, just because it was Jay-Z and he was so professional. It was ridiculous. They brought their own sound system in, his own sounds, his signs like this for TRL from like fucking in like New York and everything. And not only did he put my sound system in the Pirate's Cove, he put it back afterwards and sound checked the whole thing for me. And it's like other bands have done that, like Manowar and stuff like that, where they bring in their own sound. But nobody puts it back and gets it all put back perfect for you. They were just perfectly on time. It's like an early show before Little Flip afterwards, because I already had a show booked. And he was principal for a day in high school. He paid me, he paid like $1,400 for Peabody's, and his whole thing was guestless. So I didn't pay Jay-Z. He paid us $1,400. And he was principal for a day in the high school. Mm-hmm. And he whole guestless from, we were the surprise location for 107.9. So 700 people on a guest list, no cash at the door, no underage fee because he paid the bill. And I just got the bar and freaking he paid the club $1,400. Yeah, and he performed the longest set ever. Remember he did that crazy like 3-minute set at the Agora? He performed with Beanie Siegel, Memphis Bleak for over an hour at Peabody. Yeah, it was awesome. That was one of the coolest ones. One of my favorite band was always Gil Manteros' Party Dream. Yes. They were so much fun. I can say this now because this has been a long time ago. It wasn't really legal what I did, but it was dirty because we had Norma Jean play right before them. It was an early show, and then Gil Manteros' Party Dream, and I tried to squeeze in Norma Jean beforehand. And so we did it. We sold out Norma Jean, and then Gil Manteros had like 500, but they were still performing because they didn't go on until like 2 in the morning at 2:30, and they do like an hour and a half, 2-hour show. And at 2:30, we still had about 300 people in the club, maybe 350. I locked the door, okay, and I said it's a private party now, and I gave out drinks for free and let them play till 4 o'clock in the morning, and everybody had to go out the side door. They were just so much fun. They were like postal service on crack, man. They're wild and fun, and they were just always a great time. Second half in the local band, I was up in Rockstar and had all the record labels there because it was like 3 o'clock in the morning and I had them play like 3 times over again, just so they could play for all my friends that were the record label guys from the Cleveland Music Festival. Stuff like that we just had. It was just so much fun that I just had a blast every time I was there. You know what I mean? Mushroomhead shows were always, it was the hardest part, I used to say, was not selling out the venue, was keeping the women's clothes on at the venue. Like, so we didn't get like a liquor license fine and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So that was the hardest part of a Mushroomhead show. So like when you had a job like that and you're in your 20s, you know, you can't complain. You know, I had a really good time. It's some of the best memories of my life, and I'll never, ever, ever forget Peabody's. That's for sure. Hope to God anyways. I have some serious health issues if I ever, ever forget Peabody's.
Oh, yeah.
That's for sure.
So obviously you ended up selling Peabody's. So what year was that? 2005 when you gave it up?
Chris and Derek. Derek was in a band, American Rockstar, that used to play at Peabody's. I developed him from, they were from the South, more like the Akron area.
Mm-hmm.
And, they would draw, you know, really well. They had like TV sets on stage and stuff like that. And they presented themselves as a national act, and that helps as a local band. You know what I mean? It just, you know, even blackouts in between your songs and stuff like that. Something simple as that can set you apart from the rest of the bands that are playing, you know. With that being said, I'm gonna jump over really quick to saying one of the reasons that so many bands started playing in the Peabody shows, and somebody probably would always want to know this because that's some of the, what do you call it? some of the constructive criticism I've heard in the past. Mm-hmm. It was actually invented by me. That's the part that was invented by me for two reasons. One was because physically doing it, and like when you could only book two opening bands for a band that was coming into town, you had to the bands almost had to guarantee X amount of ticket sales. And I just saw too many times the bands were coming out of pocket and playing for the shows. You know what I mean? Now, and I personally didn't like that because I became friends with the bands and I didn't like it. Ironically, people thought it was more pay to play when I added more bands. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
However, that the reason it was invented for more bands was for nobody to have to cheat anymore, because there's so many bands, you're going to get to play in front of a good crowd. Okay. Right. There's just the band members alone, we're going to have freaking 80 of them there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And because we got three stages going on sometimes. And well, you got not only just to get the fans, well, now they're going to bring their friends. Now, some band that night, because we got so many bands, going to have the fucking best draw ever. And they're going to play before the headliner. And there might be better bands that have to play earlier. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Now you didn't have to come out of pocket for the show. And we still got a fucking huge ass crowd. And nobody has to worry about anybody guaranteeing anything. It's just winner take all. You know what I mean? Whoever does the best, great. And I never got mad at bands. Sold fucking two tickets or zero tickets. Cool. Well, you're playing first on Pirates Cove. Go for it, buddy. I got four more people here that are playing now. And you get a dollar off your drinks, but I'm still making money on that. You know what I mean? So why would I not just have more people? And I tried to make it more of a, you know, not so pay to play, to be frank with you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That was the goal of it, and have everybody just actually sell their tickets. Now, did I have bands buy tickets? I'm sure of it, 100%. You know what I mean? I'm sure it happened to buy time slots and things like that. But the goal was to get them not to have to do that. You know, if you chose to do it, that'd be one thing.
Right.
I didn't want bands to have to ever do that. You know what I mean? So that was the real reason of having so many bands play after the fact. Now, I jumped over about selling the club. So I meet Derek and Chris. I knew Derek was all about being a musician. His parents had met at Peabody's. That's how they got married. And Mushroomhead was no longer a good friend of mine at the time. And they weren't going to be the next. They weren't playing at the Wolfstein Center next. And I thought for sure I'm promoting them at the Wolfstein Center next. Anyways, it was like I lost a bunch of money on. I had to make payments on a big darkness show we lost money on. We moved it to the Agora and weren't able to do the show. Then I lost wasn't able to do like Switchfoot at the Wolfstein Center. And there was actually, I was going through, this is a big one. I was going through a $5 million lawsuit. So technically I wasn't even able to sell the place, but I did anyways, because I settled it for $3,500 because I told them, hey, we don't have $5 million. Here's the keys to the place, pay my bills too. And I walked out of the deposition. There was a guy, we did a 311 after party. Ironically, 311 is my favorite band too. 3 Days Grace played that night. And, a guy drank a beer at Becky's, then Rascal House, and the last beer was at my place at Peabody's. And then he didn't even go to the show, even though he had tickets. And he drove his buddy and him up the freeway the wrong way, and he killed two people. And because of the Great White Show that burned down that place in Rhode Island the year before, I lost my liquor liability because it went up by $63,000. I told my landlord, listen, you got to drop this out of my lease or otherwise Peabody's got to move. And because that's like all the money we make for the whole year between both of us. So I was like, I can't get that insurance. So we didn't have that insurance. And because I don't have insurance, no attorney wanted to take it. And that's why we settled for $3,500. It's actually now a precedent. Any sponsored radio show has to have $5 million in coverage. Because of that, it was a sponsored 92.3 show, and it was an undisclosed amount their insurance paid them just for sponsoring the show. But now if you have a radio sponsored show, it's now precedence because of that night, and it's fucked up, but it is true.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's for every radio station in the country because of that night now. So that was another reason I just, we had that going on. You know, it was just me and my partner. We had already done it for 5 years. I kind of wanted to get I was trying to step ladder up in business. And like, I had a nice job offer at Scene Magazine, ironically. Mm-hmm. And I had the offer to do what I was doing at Gorilla to start my own thing. Scene Magazine was going to do a cover story on me. Ironically, they ended up doing a different one later. I'll tell you that one, but they did a cover story. They were going to call me the Gorilla Marketer. And why does Sponge, when they play the Agora, draw 50 people? When they play the 100 people? Why is your box office score so crazier with the same band at one venue compared to another? And it's all about local support. That's, I just understood who could, like, I got second half an Audible thread playing right before Sponge. You know what I mean? Simple as that. You know, that's why. And the thing was, is that that's how Gorilla Music was born. Actually, they gave me the name of coming up with Gorilla. I was like, that's a great fucking name for a company.
Yeah.
Thank you. But I didn't do the actual article because it was all my trade secrets. So I was like, I don't really want to do the trade secret. And then ironically, they ended up doing like a piece on me with like a gorilla puppet guy that like he's in control of all the bands. And it was like a title, does Gorilla Screw Bands? Question mark.
Oh.
There's like a Cleveland Music Festival guy that said, yeah, I told the guy I sold 35 tickets. I only sold 15. So he's changed my time slot. I was like, you're trying to fuck over the other bands. That's what it worked. That's the structure of my business model. Thank you. Yes. I did. And then there was like Skinny in there from Mushroomhead. Like, dude, we do all of our shows with Dan because that's what we do. Jeff Blue from like Atlantic Records going, dude, I love flying in for the festivals and working with Dan. Like every, the actual, if you read the article, it's amazing for me, but they try to make me out really, really bad because of pay to play. Ironically, the funny thing is two parts. One, the guy that actually drew that whole thing, I was drinking with him at my restaurant called Redstone in Battery Park, and I didn't know it. It was the second time I had been drinking with him. We were talking. He's like, dude, I got to tell you something. You're really fucking cool. And I drew that fucking thing on Scene Magazine. I have it over at 78 Studios. You want to go over? I want to give it to you. And he fucking, I have the original artwork trying to motherfuck me.
Yeah.
And I have the actual artwork. I gave it to my brother for Christmas one year, right after that, because he was my partner too.
Aw.
He's very sensitive, so he was hurt by it. I loved it because I'm like, no such thing as bad press. It was a crazy time for me at that time too. So it was some wild ass shit that came out. And it was, but the other part I wanted to bring up, the year after this, I bought the C Music Awards. Talk about pay to play. I paid for it. We brought in Filter, which is my brother's first band. Richard Patrick, we hung up, me and my brother and Richard hung out afterwards and drank beers at the bar. And it was actually, that's how their music awards. I bought the fucking front page of the Scene magazine. They did an article of me and my brother hugging and like this smear piece, of, like loving us up and everything. Just trying to make up for everything they did. Because everybody motherfucked them over the article because it's just, you try to make us look bad when all we tried to do this whole time was help the city. Like, to be frank with you, after this, I have a ticketing platform now, but I stopped doing Gorilla for a lot of reasons like that. It's like, dude, I was working 70 hours a week and bands are thinking I'm just cashing checks left and right. You know what I mean? And it's just like, at the end of the day, I'm making 50 grand a year working 75 hours a week. And it's like, dude, you don't get it. And that's when I was at my height. You know what I mean? You're making $30,000 a year. And it's, I got into real estate after that. And, it worked out a lot better for me, but I still, this is my passion. That's why I've got the ticketing platform. It's going to be patented actually. Well, our patent is we own electronically time slots based on ticket sales. So if you have a performance and your slots are based on the ticket sales, that's our patent. You license it through us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's what it's based on. It doesn't matter if it's a musician or a magician or a comedian or whatever have you, a fighter. That's what the performance based on that. And it actually does it electronically. So if you go to eventworks.com, you'll see all these performers, the top ticket sellers at the top, the lowest, the zero ticket sellers at the bottom, and they change in real time.
Yeah.
We've done $100,000 in development, but I gave up half the company to do that. So it's working. It's pretty cool stuff. It's like, it's basically the future because you don't need physical tickets anymore. And now the bands, it's another piece that the bands can't bitch because before, like some people would, like other promoters that do might use my system too. Like if you lost tickets, things like that, they try to make you pay for them. And this system, well, you don't do that. And you don't even have to trust your promoter anymore because there's going to be a DocuSign and you get paid from the ticketing company. So the promoter, the venue, and the band sign an agreement and then we pay everybody out through your ticketing. Yeah. So whatever you agree on with the promoter, they have to actually honor it because at midnight they're getting paid.
Yeah, there you go. Hell yeah, dude. All right. So just to wrap this up, Peabody's obviously is come and gone. Those days are now, it's been over 10 years since Peabody's closed its doors. Is that right? Has it been?
Probably about that.
Right. Nine, 10 years. When you look back on it, just overall, what do you think the legacy of Peabody's Down Under will be?
we were the CBGBs of Cleveland. You know, that's really what we were. It's a loving, diverse music venue, you know?
I absolutely have to agree. It's the name, like anybody that was around that time frame, you say Peabody's, everybody instantly recognizes it. And it's always good stories. It's always, you know, I saw Body Count there. I saw, you know, Crypt Kicker there. I told
my kids that the other night because Ice-T was on the back of a cereal box. I was like, I had him at Peabody's.
Yeah, I saw him
on Coco that night too.
yes. I remember them doing, was that the night that I think Violent J from the Insane Clown Posse came out and they did Cop Killer. And I was like, I was drunker than piss. And I was like, I have an ICP tattoo. I was a Juggalo kid. And
nice. So I was at a lot of Juggalo shows.
I was at all of them. but yeah, I always tell people, I go, I saw Violent J do Cop Killer with Ice-T right before, because there was a lot of, I remember there being police there. and I was like, there's actual cops here, like, you know, walking around and stuff. And Ice-T did a big old speech and stuff. And I like, who else? It was like everybody from, yeah, Life of Agony to you name it, you know.
Life of Agony, that was one of my favorite bands that ever played there, man. Oh, yeah, I love that band.
They're so fan. We became
good buddies. Every time that they would load in, it would be funny because for some reason I would be sleeping there every night that they would load in, and I'd be already there. And they're like, "You sleep here all the time?" I'm like, actually, no. It just happens to you guys every time.
Oh man, well, dude, thank you so much for taking the time out and telling us some stuff and
I got excited about it and I was like, man, I'd love talking about Peabody's and reminiscing of the old times, and it's just nothing but love from Peabody's. And it's I felt like Mr. Peabody's for almost a decade, and it was an incredible time.
Heck yeah, man. Well, thank you again, dude. I hope you have a great rest of your night, and
My brother,
I hope to talk to you again sometime, dude.
Sounds good, my brother. Have a great night.
Hey man, you too.
Thanks for listening. This is Keeping It 99. Subscribe on whatever app it is. Are you listening on an app? What are you listening in? What are you listening on? Is there a subscribe button? Can you do it? Can you give me money? Or just subscribe? Just tell somebody you heard the show.